From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Desperate Networks. We talk with Bill Carter. His new book is about how broadcast TV is trying to compete. Carter covers the TV industry for the New York Times. Also, former Secretary of State and UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright talks about her new book, The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs. We remember financial journalist Louis Rukeyser. He died yesterday at the age of 73. And Ken Tucker reviews Neil Young's new protest album, Living with War, which includes his song, Let's Impeach the President. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cable, iPods, DVDs, DVRs, video games, and the internet are all taking a bite out of the ratings of the major broadcast networks. Bill Carter's new book, Desperate Networks, looks at how the networks have battled for hit shows and ad revenues over the past few years, years that saw the ending of Friends and NBC's Thursday night ratings juggernaut. Carter documents the onslaught of reality TV, from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Survivor, The Apprentice, and The Bachelor, to the current powerhouse, American Idol. Carter also reveals the behind-the-scenes stories of how some of the most successful shows were passed up by other networks. Bill Carter covers the TV industry for the New York Times and is the author of the bestseller The Late Shift about late-night TV. Bill Carter, your book starts with Bob Wright, the chair of NBC, trying to find out if Mark Cherry, the creator of Desperate Housewives, pitched his show to NBC before taking it to ABC. And as we all know, it became a huge hit at ABC. Why did you start your book there? What's the significance of this story?
Well, I just think that the Desperate Housewives story is kind of emblematic of the way television works, which is somebody has a good idea and an awful lot of people ignore it. And finally, somebody decides that it's a good idea. And this was a guy who struggled for 7 years being basically unemployed and no one would pay attention to him. And then all of a sudden, he had the hottest idea in the country. And it was interesting that you had a chairman of a network, of a big, you know, media conglomerate, calling this guy, cold calling him on the phone to find out what happened and why his network had missed this tremendous opportunity.
So what did Bob Wright, the chair of NBC, do once he found out for sure that his network did miss the opportunity, that they were pitched before ABC?
He made a few other calls to speak to the people who had not listened to Mr. Cherry to find out, well, why did they not respond to his script the way they people at ABC had? And I guess he got some answers, and a few of the people who were involved are no longer there.
So what did Desperate Housewives do for ABC?
It transformed them in ways that only hit television shows can do to a network. It basically made an ice-cold network into a red-hot network, basically overnight, within the first week it was on the air. Of course, it came on the air at the same time that ABC launched another enormous hit, which is very unusual. Their other hit was Lost. But Desperate Housewives was really a statement that ABC was not out of business. They were on the cusp of really being written off, that they could never come back. And this show, because the response to it was so instantaneous, made everyone all of a sudden say, instead of being a network we're not going to pay any attention to, it's the network where everybody has to pay all the attention to because it has the hottest show.
Meanwhile, Fox is killing the networks on Tuesday nights with American Idol.
It's killing the networks pretty much across the board now. I mean, not every night, but Idol has driven so many other shows to success. They put shows behind it, like 24, which has become an extremely popular show. And now they have a medical show called House, which they launched behind American Idol, and that's become an enormous hit. And they can use American Idol like no other show on television. They can stretch it out. When it starts, they run it three nights a week. It's always on at least two nights a week. And it just vaporizes any competition. It is really quite a phenomenon. I don't think I've ever seen it in all the years I've covered television, a show quite this powerful. And it's quite a weapon for Fox, and they've used it really, really well.
So meanwhile, CBS, NBC, ABC, they're not only competing with cable, they're competing with Fox. And they're competing with UPN and the WB, which have just merged. But those networks, you know, capture a lot of younger viewers, right? They're more niche oriented, but they capture a lot of African American and younger viewers. So what's left for what CBS, NBC, and ABC are fighting over? They seem to be fighting over a smaller and smaller share of the market.
There's no question that it is shrinking, that the market is shrinking. And when they have shows that don't hit, they now are basically out of business. One of the things that's changed in television is you can't get by with mediocre or poor performing shows. They're going to completely tank on them, and they have to drag those shows along. They have to depend on breaking through really on a big scale now for basically most of their income. The lower end shows are complete failures now. In the old days, they could sort of, you know, get by because there wasn't that much competition. Now, if you don't have really successful and very big popular shows, you are in serious, serious trouble.
Is that why so many shows just kind of end after two episodes?
That's exactly why. They get a pretty good read right away I mean, ABC put on a show this year called Emily's Reasons Why Not. It was on, they put billboards all over the country for this show. They promoted it to the max. It was on 1 week. They looked at the rating after 1 week and they said, there is no hope for this show. And it was never seen again. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. If it doesn't come out of the gate fast, they can't wait. They can't waste their time. So they'll put a repeat of a successful show on because it doesn't cost as much money and it'll probably do better in the ratings.
It must be crazy making, though, at the networks because you never really settle in. You invest all this time and money into something and then you give up on it immediately.
Yeah, and you can imagine how it is for the creators of a show like that. They put all that effort into it. They've already made 6 or maybe even 13 shows by the time they put one on. And after 1 week, you're out of business. You're canceled after 1 week. The business has become extremely precarious because of that.
Your book, Desperate Networks, focuses a lot on reality programming. Is reality TV outside of American Idol still as hot as it was?
Well, it isn't quite as hot as it was, but I think it's a mistake to write it off because the format really works on a lot of levels for the networks. It's cheaper to produce. There's a skew to it that's very young, which they like. When they work, they get a lot of young viewers. And in the last 6 or 7 years, the big breakthrough shows have been basically dominated by that format. So people are still tinkering with it. Obviously, what's hurt it is there's been endless copies of every successful one. So the originals have lost a little bit of their pizzazz because everybody copies them. And they do tend to run, except for American Idol, they do tend to run their cycle out pretty fast. Like The Apprentice was an enormous hit for NBC, but they had to run it so frequently, 2 cycles a year, that they wore the audience out. There was a couple of shows, new ones this year, that have done extremely well. I mean, this show called Dancing with the Stars, which ABC put on, it's really their only successful new show on ABC this year. So I don't think the format is dying. I think they just have to be original with it and not constantly do copies.
Now, you write about how Survivor was pitched to CBS by its creator, Mark Burnett, and how CBS and Burnett formed an unusual partnership. What made this partnership unusual?
Well, the strange thing about it was Mark Burnett had pitched this show to everybody and really maybe even 2 or 3 times to everybody. And it only got traction when a real unknown underling executive at CBS decided it was an exciting idea. And he went to the boss of CBS, Les Moonves, and he pitched it to him. And Les, listening to the idea, his initial reaction was, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. And he basically threw the guy out of his office. But he didn't give up on the idea. So when this executive named Gen Maynard kept coming back and pushing, Les started to listen to it. But he made an interesting requirement. He said, I'm not going to waste any money on this. I'm not going to lose any money. If you guys can get sponsors to fully back this show before it goes on the air so that CBS doesn't have to pay a penny for it, then we'll put it on the air. And Mark Burnett is a very good sales guy, and he went out with some of the CBS salespeople and he found advertisers, and they wound up selling the show. So it was a basically fully sponsored show when it went on the air. But that is not a formula that usually is conventional in television. So they had to make a new arrangement. They created a company called the Survivor Company, which was a 50-50 split between CBS and Mark Burnett. And they didn't think this show would work, so they didn't know what was going to happen in the future, and they left it kind of wide open as to what would happen if this thing worked. So it works on an enormous scale. It is such a big hit that Les Moonves adds an entire episode, 2 entire new episodes to the show and adds commercials to the show. And they have to come to Les and say, well, we can do that, Les, but, you know, it's a 50-50 deal. This guy's going to get half. He's going to get half the advertising revenue. And Moonves was furious because that's never supposed to be done in television. You don't give away the advertising revenue to the creator. But even worse, from his point of view, they hadn't built in a license fee, a fee for the show to come back. So again, Mark Burnett had them by the throat, and they had to give him an enormous amount of money to bring this show back on CBS a second time. Now, it paid off for everybody because the show remained an enormous hit, and everyone made a lot of money.
CBS also had to come up with a contract to indemnify CBS against accidents and injuries.
Yes.
And all kinds. Tell us a little bit about this contract that they came up with for Survivor.
Well, it was interesting. No one had ever done a show with like real people as the center of this sort of action adventure show. And no one knew what would happen. And they were scared because when Survivor had been tried one other time in Sweden, And it was a big hit there in Sweden. But in the first round of it, when they eliminated the first contestant was voted off the island in the first Swedish show, he went back to Sweden and he committed suicide. And everyone was like, wow, this show must wreck people. So they didn't know how to deal with any of this. So they wrote this elaborate contract to cover any eventuality, like if you were attacked by crocodiles or birds or monkeys, or you caught some tropical disease, or you had to write off rights to everything possible that could happen to you before they let you on. And even then, they went through a lot of these strange psychological tests with these people to make sure that they weren't, like, you know, high strung. And they brought them to California and they put them up in a hotel, and then they would, like, wake them up at 2 o'clock in the morning and put them through these like, you know, extensive personality tests and to find out if they would, like, fly off the handle. And, you know, eventually that became, interestingly, the template for virtually all the reality shows that followed it. They basically made these people give up the rights to everything, including the right to even discuss the show. Once they were off, they were at risk of losing $5 million if they revealed to anyone the outcome of the show. And it really became the template. Every reality show does it now.
My guest is Bill Carter. He covers the TV industry for the New York Times. His new book is called Desperate Networks. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Carter. He covers the television industry for the New York Times. His new book is called Desperate Networks. You describe Mike Darnell as the impresario of reality TV for Fox. What were his big successes?
Well, he had been the guy responsible for some of the most memorable of these outrageous specials that Fox did in the late 90s and the early part of the century, where he brought, you know, these strange video things together, like, you know, the world's greatest police chases and when animals attack and when good pets go bad and outrageous behavior caught on tape. And these are really the most violent or outrageous scenes that people caught on their camcorders and video recorders and packaged together. And they were enormously successful in an audience way, but not in an advertiser way. Advertisers felt they were trashy and sleazy and didn't want to pay for them, but they would generate very big ratings for Fox. And Darnell was like an impresario of this. He loved this material. And the thing about Mike is he's not a guy who puts this on because he's just sheerly being exploitative. He actually likes this. He loves the idea of, you know, grabbing some people and making them a little bit offended or a little bit shocked, or, you know, they sitting back from the TV and saying, I can't believe this is on television. He thought that was a great way to, you know, boost people's ratings and give Fox a name, which he did. He was very much sort of the signature executive at Fox because they became known for these kind of outrageous special programs.
And what are some of the problems he ran into with his contestants?
Well, he did a show called The Chamber, which was it was essentially like almost torturing somebody. It was supposed to be a quiz show where they put people in this cage and then they would either turn, really like roast them on a spit. They like had flames coming up underneath them. They were shooting them with water while they were asking them quiz questions. And at one point when they were doing the pilot for the show, they had a guy in this cage and he got stuck. And the guy was literally like frying under these flames, and they barely got him out in time before he was like cooked inside this torture chamber. That show didn't work, but it was a perfect show for Mike Darnell because it captured all of his kind of outrageous taste.
Are the networks worried that one day somebody's going to die on one of these reality adventure shows?
Well, in fact, they were very worried about that at Fox. In fact, the executive in charge at that point, a woman named Gail Berman, when she first met with Mike Darnell, one of the first things out of her mouth was, listen, Mike, nobody dies on my watch. And he really had to be careful with Mike because another idea he had for a show was a guy doing what he called a space jump. that was going to take him in a plane into the stratosphere and have a guy jump out in a parachute. And some people said, well, wait, he might die. You know, we better not do this. He also had an idea to take a 747 that was being made out of, you know, taken out of service and fly it above a desert where he would then have it point nose down, have the pilot parachute out, have it loaded up with cameras and watch it just plow into the desert. I don't know how you'd make an hour-long show out of that, but they thought it was unsafe.
So other network executives declined on those.
Yes, and interestingly, Fox was considered sort of outrageous for doing this and below the belt. But the network, the other networks, even as they were complaining about what they were doing on Fox, they were trying to hire Mike Darnell. They were like bringing him in for interviews and trying to hire him because, boy, was he generating ratings.
You know, your book is partly about how networks pass on ideas that turn out to be brilliant ideas and end up being successes for competing networks. An example of that is American Idol. You write that no network executives, even the ones at Fox, were enthusiastic about it when Simon Cowell first pitched it.
No, it was a remarkable thing. Simon Cowell came to the U.S. With his partner, Simon Fuller, and they had invented the idea of a contest, an amateur singing contest, and they sold it to British television in basically a half an hour. But they were well known in Britain for their, you know, ability in making recording artists. So when they came to the United States, nobody knew who they were. So they went around, you know, to various networks and pitched this idea. And people listened to them thinking, you know, who are these guys? Are they serious? You know, we never heard of these guys. And they got absolutely nowhere. They were thrown out of meetings. They were really mistreated and dismissed, essentially. And, you know, Cowell is kind of a kind of guy who can shrug that sort of thing off and think to himself, well, you know, you're going to regret this later. So he went back to England and they started the show in England and it was an enormous success in England. And then they partnered up with a big talent agency, CAA, and came back at the networks again. Now, they'd already turned down the idea once and now they have a second chance and they have the evidence that the show is a big hit in England. Well, again, they get turned down by everybody. ABC had turned them down twice, even after seeing the tape from the British show, which at least gave you an idea of what it would be and probably gave you an idea of how successful it could be. They were turned down again. Now, Fox had a need for a summer show. Survivor had been a big hit in the summer, so people had seen that you could put reality on in the summer and basically get away from doing repeats at the very least. So they had a need for a summer show, but they didn't want to spend a nickel on this. So when Simon Cowell and Simon Fuller came to pitch the show, they said, as Les Moonves had said about Survivor, if you get sponsors who will advertise in this show and buy the whole show out, then we'll consider it, but we won't spend a nickel on it. We won't pay you at all. And Fox is just sitting on this show. And actually, they gave the British people a 48-hour deadline and said, you know, if you don't get advertisers on this in 48 hours, we're going to just drop the whole idea. And at that point, the show, because it was so big in England, was obviously seen by the British audience. And a very important viewer was Elizabeth Murdoch, the daughter of Rupert Murdoch, who obviously owns the Fox network. Elizabeth Murdoch ran the B Sky B channel in England, which was not where Pop Idol, as it was called in England, was playing. It was playing on ITV. But she saw it every week and could see how big it was and what a hit it was. And she called up her father and she said, you know, Dad, I hear that your network, Fox, is negotiating for this and nothing's happening. You ought to know this is an enormous show. I think you should buy it. So Rupert Murdoch calls his people at Fox and he says, you know, I'm hearing that you guys are negotiating for this Idol show. And they said, well, you know, yes, we've been talking about it. We're thinking about it. And Murdoch just said, listen, stop thinking about it. Buy it. And he ordered them to buy it. And that turned the whole thing around. They would not have done it. I think the 48 hours would have run out because they didn't have the advertisers. And Fox would have turned that show down if Rupert Murdoch had not gotten a phone call from his daughter. And the dramatic effect that that's had on Fox cannot even be measured. It's so enormous. And it all happened by chance, the way a lot of these hit shows happen.
What has it meant for Fox to have American Idol?
Well, there's no show that can come close to it in terms of what an advertiser will pay for a 30-second commercial. The average price for a commercial on network TV might be $200,000, $250,000 for a good show. This show gets $450,000 at a minimum. And for its finale this year, it's getting $1.3 million $1,000 for a 30-second episode. That's at the Super Bowl level. That's just a gigantic price. So initially, they get the revenue from the show. Secondly, they get this tremendous circulation of viewers. I mean, 35 million viewers a week are coming to their network to watch this show. And at all those times that they do that, Fox can promote their other shows. And that's helped a lot of the new shows that they've added. And as I said earlier, they can also put shows adjacent to American Idol and launch them as hits. So at the same time, the fourth thing that it does is it kills the competition. So if another network is getting a show launched that Fox thinks might be a threat, they'll move American Idol against it and try to crush it. They did that this year with ABC had a show called Commander in Chief, which started off the season doing pretty well. But it was on Tuesday nights, which is when Idol comes on. So when Idol came on at the turn of the season in January, it just crushed that show. And ABC was not probably going to be able to bring that show back now. So it just had an enormous across-the-board impact on Fox that I think is almost unmeasurable. There's never been a show, I think, quite this powerful for one network to use against the others.
Well, Bill Carter, thank you very much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it a lot, Terry. Thank you.
Bill Carter covers the TV industry for the New York Times. His new book is called Desperate Networks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's some of the final performance on last night's American Idol.
She knows, and all I have to do is think of her. Something in the way she knows.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. And from Turner Classic Movies, presenting Race and Hollywood, Black Images on Film, a 38-film retrospective with discussion and commentary, Tuesday and Thursday nights in May. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Neil Young's new protest album, Living with War. We talk with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright about her new book on America, God, and World Affairs. And we listen back to an interview with financial journalist Louis Rukeyser. He died yesterday at the age of 73. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neil Young's new album, Living with War, generated a lot of attention before it was even recorded, when it was announced that he was including a song called Let's Impeach the President. Young recorded the album in a little over a week in early April. He was so anxious to get its music heard that he posted the entire album on his website last Friday, free to anyone. Yesterday, the album went on sale in CD form. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of Living with War.
Won't need no shadow man running the government. Won't need
As that opening song called After the Garden suggests, this is primarily a Neil Young electric rock and roll album, as opposed to an acoustic Neil Young folky album. The choice of style is significant. Young has long opted for loud power chords and brute simple lyrics when he wants to get a message out. That message could be, as it was in 1970s Ohio, that four students were shot dead at Kent State University. Or in 2001's Roll On, that some determined passengers had brought down a hijacked plane in Pennsylvania. This time, the message is both direct and more widely dispersed. "Don't need no more lies," he yells over and over on a song called Restless Consumer. He does an end run around potential criticism of his politics by praising the family unit in all its forms on a song called simply Families. He claims the symbolism of the flag for himself and for people of any political persuasion on another tune, Flags of Freedom. And Let's Impeach the President is pretty self-explanatory. Young has always been a partisan contrarian. Remember, he endorsed Ronald Reagan for president in 1984. A song here called Looking for a Leader suggests a little desperately, quote, "America has a leader, but he's not in the house. He's walking here among us, and we've got to seek him out." That walking among us phraseology has a New Testament ring to it, as does his punning use of the word house. White House? Houses of Congress? The House of God? This is in keeping with the rest of the album. Using a 100-voice choir to sing an utterly unironic America the Beautiful. Quoting the Star-Spangled Banner with gorgeous subtlety in the title song. And insisting on taking back flag, family, and religion from the right and spreading it around among everyone, including Democrats and libertarians, which I think is probably where Young's tortured politics really align most closely. He wants to be left alone. There are numerous strenuous objections to the Homeland Security Act salted into a number of songs. And on Looking for a Leader, he suggests that people consider all sorts of possibilities, from Colin Powell to Illinois Senator Barack Obama, as alternative candidates. It's pop music as political product placement. I'll bet John McCain's people are gnashing their teeth and rending their garments that Young couldn't find a way to wedge their man into the song.
Looking for a leader to bring our country home. Reunite the red, white, and blue before it turns to stone. Looking for somebody young enough to take it on. Clean up the corruption and make the country strong.
Young's rallying cry here is, clean out the corruption and make the country strong. With the phrase, "Maybe it's a woman or a black man after all," he implies that he doesn't know who he wants, he just wants change. The canny thing he's done here is to call for that change within melodies and songwriting styles that will appeal immensely to his most loyal audience segment. Those old and young at his concerts who sing along with the chorus, "Hey, hey, my, my, rock and roll will never die." He's using the internet and new marketing strategies to release music that wouldn't be out of place on 70s albums such as Tonight's the Night and On the Beach. Except that in 2006, for Neil Young, tonight's the night of a national nightmare, and we're on the beach looking for aircraft carriers to land with fresh body bags.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Living with War by Neil Young. Coming up, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She's written a new book about America, God, and world affairs. This is Fresh Air. Does the U.S. believe it has a special relationship with God? Does it have a divinely inspired mission to promote liberty? These are the kinds of questions Madeleine Albright addresses in her new book, The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs. Albright was the first woman to be Secretary of State. She served under President Clinton after first serving as his U.N. ambassador. Her memoir, Madam Secretary, was a bestseller. Why did you want to write a book about religion and politics?
Well, because I wanted to really look forward in terms of what the issues were for foreign policy. I wanted to look forward and look at the major forces that were at work as we go into the 21st century. And I have to tell you, I used to say this, and now that I can't believe I actually said it because it was so presumptuous. And that was that it wasn't that I was just the first female Secretary of State, but I was the last Secretary of State of the 20th century and the first of the 21st. And I think we saw the 21st century in a more hopeful way, I have to say, that, you know, we all made a little bit of fun of President Clinton, who used to say that he was building a bridge into the next century. And we were looking at how to revise a lot of our institutions and how to look at what the challenges of the 21st century were, all of which were basically transnational issues to do with the environment and health and drugs and nuclear proliferation. And all of a sudden, I think that a lot was turned upside down with 9/11 and questions of, were we dealing with a religion out of the 7th century, and what was happening in terms of our interpretation of our relationship with God, and going back to issues that had been troubling for a long time and didn't seem like 21st century issues. And I wanted to explore how, in fact, the 21st century was evolving and what we could do to get back to the hopeful aspect of it.
You write in your book that you can't remember any leading American diplomat speaking in depth about the role of religion in shaping the world. What were you taught when you were coming up through the ranks about the role of religion in diplomacy?
Well, I think I'm pretty standard for my generation, and also somebody who spent a lot of time reading Dean Acheson and George Kennan and Hans Morgenthau, who have a very, what is known as a realistic, realpolitik view of foreign policy, which is that life is complicated enough, the conflicts are very difficult, so the last thing you want to do is inject God and religion into it. It only complicates things. And so mostly when we ran into issues, people would say, we don't need to bring God and religion into it. And I really came to realize, as I was Secretary of State, that actually one had to bring God and religion into it, not because I'm a theologian or because I've turned into a religious mystic, but because there really are some tools that allow us to help solve some of the problems.
Like what? What are you thinking of?
Well, I think that as one looks at the three monotheistic religions, you see that there are many elements in common. There is clearly an understanding of the importance of love and charity and respect for the individual and a variety of ways that things are framed in the same way, that if religious leaders talk to each other, they are able to find the common threads. And what we have seen to a great extent is that religion over the centuries has been a very divisive aspect, and I'm, I hope not in vain, thinking about the way that religion and religious leaders can actually help to break down what some of the problems are and through using religion can bring people together.
But as a former Secretary of State and UN Ambassador, you've been in a lot of situations where you've seen religion as the divisive factor as opposed to the kind of healing, ethical, moral factor.
I have. And but you know what is interesting? And for instance, I have been asked whether there were times we should have thought about this in more detail. And actually, I would just, if I can take a minute, talk about our experience at Camp David in the summer of 2000. President Clinton, who is a religious man but has not made religion a policy, and he and I've talked about this, and he said he read the Bible and he read the Torah and was looking for ways that there might be elements that would be helpful. And we even, as we were dealing with the issue of Jerusalem, came up, and the issue was sovereignty, we came up with the idea that perhaps we could talk about the holy places as being under divine sovereignty. And so we were looking at ways that religion could help. But I think the place where we made a mistake was in the following way. A lot of people think we went to Camp David because President Clinton wanted a legacy. That's not why we were there. It was because Prime Minister Ehud Barak felt that the last months of President Clinton's presidency could be useful for exploring some bold ideas that he had. And Chairman Arafat did not want to come. And I actually had to persuade him to come. I don't think he actually was capable in the end of making a very difficult decision of seeing himself as a president rather than as a freedom fighter. But we thought that he could make the decisions about the dispositions of the holy places in Jerusalem. And the truth is that that was not his sole responsibility. We should have considered much more what the other Muslim leaders thought and how they could support him. But because Prime Minister Barak had wanted to keep a lot of the discussions close to his vest and had not really given us a lot of bottom lines, we were not able to mobilize some of the other leaders to help in supporting Arafat in what was arguably a very difficult decision. So it's pieces like that of trying to bring in religion and understanding what the issues are in a very difficult problem. It's not the solution to everything, but I do think that if our diplomats were better trained in religion, they would understand better some of the implications of issues that are beyond, that are not cultural, but are religious.
When you found out that you were Jewish, did that have any impact on your diplomatic work and how you worked with countries that were primarily countries of one religion, whether that was, you know, Christian or Muslim or Jewish?
Well, the short answer is no. I mean, I have a very complicated religious background. I kid a little bit about the fact that I was raised a Catholic, married an Episcopalian, found out I was Jewish, which is why I think I'm capable of having written this book. But it is a complicated background. I grew up with certain moral standards and beliefs, and I am also very much a child of World War II. And while I certainly knew about the Holocaust, I didn't know that it applied to me personally. And I had certain beliefs about how one dealt with various issues. I don't think it affected me. I had there were lots of people, actually, before I became Secretary of State, who said that a woman of whatever religion could not deal with Arab countries particularly. And I actually found I had no problems. I went to many Arab countries. I, of course, did arrive in a very large plane that said United States of America. But when they dealt with me, they knew, or when they wanted to deal with the United States, they had to deal with me. And I sometimes say I actually had more problems with the men in our own government who had seen me kind of rise through the ranks and wondered how I'd gotten to be Secretary of State. So I did not have those kinds of problems. I had always had very strong beliefs about the importance of the American relationship with Israel. So from my own perspective, I did not have any change of heart, having found out about an addition to my already very rich heritage.
My guest is Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State and former U.N. Ambassador. Her new book is called The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs. You write in your book that the invasion of Iraq may eventually rank among the worst foreign policy disasters in U.S. history. What do you think the long-term repercussions might be?
Well, I think they are very, very significant. First of all, I, from the very beginning, said that this was a war of choice, not of necessity. I totally agreed with what President Bush said about Saddam Hussein, and I said the same things, and I actually said them longer, for 8 years. But I didn't understand why the war had to happen when it did. We had not finished the job in Afghanistan, and that's, after all, where the terrorists came from. And we certainly did not have an adequate plan for the post-invasion aspect of this. The repercussions are many. One is, obviously, that Iraq is a mess. That's a diplomatic term of art. And we don't know what is going to happen to it. There have been suggestions about a more federally formed Iraq and with a weaker central government, but an existing one. But what I'm concerned about is actually the breakup of Iraq, which, in fact, would be totally destabilizing with the Kurds linking up with other Kurds and Shias with Iran and Sunnis under the influence of Saudi Arabia. It's a very complex story, but certainly the breakup of Iraq is one issue. The second is, I think, one of the biggest unintended consequences, and that is the rise of Iran as a regional power, and certainly one where we're unclear about their nuclear ambitions. The third is that the message out of Iraq is wrong. The president talked about the axis of evil, and that was Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. If I were either Kim Jong-il or President Ahmadinejad, I would read that to say, if you don't have nuclear weapons, you get invaded, and if you do have nuclear weapons, you don't get invaded. We didn't invade the Soviet Union, Russia, or China, and we did invade Iraq. And then, finally, I think in many ways it puts some question as to what American power is all about and our reputation. I loved, and I underline that, representing the United States. I knew that we were not perfect, but I did see us as an exceptional nation. And what we're now asking is that exceptions be made for us, and our moral authority has been seriously damaged. And that's why I say that this could turn out to be one of the greatest disasters. I hope it isn't. There isn't anybody I know that wants us to fail. I hope it isn't. But it is, you know, there are not a lot of people that look at Iraq now and say, I'd like my country to look just like this.
Madeleine Albright, you were the first female Secretary of State. Condoleezza Rice is the second. You disagree with Condoleezza Rice on a lot of political matters, but you have something very much in common, which is that you were the first and second secretaries of states who were women. Do you ever commiserate about that with her?
Well, we do, but do you know we have something else in common, which is that my father was her professor and actually persuaded her to go into international relations. So it is one of the really interesting coincidences, and she and I've talked about that. She says that my father was the major influence on her in her life. When I worked for a lot of Democratic presidential candidates, and one of them, I called her up, and she said, "Madeline, I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm a Republican." And I said, "Condi, how could you be when we had the same father?" So she and I have talked about that. We don't commiserate, because I think I certainly loved being Secretary of State, and there's every indication that she does. And she's very busy and she's traveling, so we haven't spent a great deal of time on personal issues. But when she first became National Security Advisor and I was still Secretary, we had some conversations about how to operate within the U.S. government.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for your really incredibly important and difficult questions, Terry.
Madeline Albright's new book is called The Mighty and the Almighty. Coming up, we remember Louis Rukeyser, who became famous as the host of Wall Street Week. He died yesterday. This is Fresh Air. Financial journalist Louis Rukeyser died yesterday of multiple myeloma at the age of 73. As the host of the popular public television series Wall Street Week from 1970 to 2002, Rukeyser became known for making financial talk interesting, accessible, and funny. In The New Yorker, John Brooks wrote that he had a knack for providing entertainment unrivaled by any other television commentator on economic matters, past or present. People magazine called Rukeyser the dismal science's only sex symbol. I spoke with Rukeyser in 1984. He told me he realized most people don't consider business and economics the most scintillating things to talk about on TV.
You say economics to the average person, and it's perfectly true that the chin will hit the chest and the eyelids will grow a little heavy. But you say money, and wow, you get a reaction. The eyelids pop open and the nostrils flare, and you have that person's full attention. I think money is one of the two principal preoccupations of the average American, and the only one of the two that you can discuss during the family hour on television.
When you started doing television, hosting your own show on a regular basis, you had to have given some thought to what kind of image was most appropriate for the host of a Wall Street-oriented program. What kind of consideration did you give that, and how did you come up with what you did?
Well, I have never been preoccupied with image because I've always tried to be my own person, and indeed, long before Wall Street Week, the time in which I started to have real success in television is when I recognized something that we all should recognize, but it seems we have to learn it one by one, which is that in my case, I wasn't going to be the second Walter Cronkite, and I wasn't going to be the second David Brinkley, but I could be the first Louis Rukeyser. And besides, I was stuck with it. That's who I was. People, even now, are confused by a career like mine because it's taken a number of different twists and turns, and I do a number of different things now, and they'll say to me, "What are you really?" Americans want to pigeonhole people. And I've always said, well, I'm an authentic Louis Rukeyser.
In your book, What's Ahead for the Economy, you say that too many academic economists are Marxists, and that you think the students graduating from programs like that leave with a really undeveloped view of economic reality. What's your criticism?
Well, I make two points there, that there are two growing schools on America's campuses. That's one of them. The Marxist school is apparently growing. But the other, more hopefully, is the pro-free enterprise group, much more significant than it was 15 years ago, when a lot of crackpots on the campuses were acting as if business was the enemy, as if you could have a wonderful economy and still be anti-business. Well, let me tell you a little secret. Business is the economy. When you say, how's business, that's how the economy is. And therefore, we had a mini generation of people who were anti-business, anti-profit, and are now discovering, one by one, that we did a pretty good job of being anti-profit and anti-business. We wrecked the profitability of a large portion of American industry. We did a pretty good job of discouraging savings and investment in this country. We did a pretty good job of discouraging employment growth in this country. We did a pretty good job of wrecking the financial markets in the 1970s, made the stock and bond markets sick jokes. But we didn't help the poor. We didn't eliminate poverty in this country. We didn't eliminate unemployment. I think the biggest myth in America today is the myth that the economy is a constant class war with winners and losers, and that therefore the government, the politician of all people, ought to be brought in to hand out the arms more fairly. In fact, as we've seen throughout history, when we attack one element of society, we all suffer. And on the other hand, the years when the poorest Americans really did best, the years when we really took people in substantial numbers off the poverty rolls, off the welfare rolls, and put them to work permanently in the private economy, the years in which the middle class of America really did better, really saw its family standard of living improving every year and could count on that, were the years of booming business profits, were the years of a soaring stock market. So instead of this class war idea, I hope that in the next few years we're going to get back to the idea that we are one nation and that we're all going to work together a little more. And one of the things we're going to work together on is keeping the politicians from lousing it up after we've built it up.
Louis Rukeyser recorded in 1984. He died yesterday at the age of 73. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Play to the End, a novel of psychological suspense by Robert Goddard, author of Hand in Glove. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Rykoff, the founder and executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. One of their aims is to see that troops in active duty and veterans are properly provided for. Rykoff has written a memoir called Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington. Join us for the next Fresh Air.